Don't you just hate it when you overreact?
I think we all overreact. If you take a look at the studies, we're all hardwired to have a response, which is both in our bodies and in our mind. It's just a question of how sturdy a person is, which means how likely are they to overreact instead of reacting thoughtfully.
That's Judith Siegel. Her book is Stop Overreacting, Effective Strategies for Calming Your Emotions. And in the second half of today's show, we'll air a 2008 interview with Les Femi about how to use our powers of attention to calm our stress and handle our challenges. His book is The Open Focus Brain. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We've all done it. Whether it's blowing up at our spouse or kids, screaming at the car that cuts ahead of us in traffic, or shutting down into a silent, bitter sulk at work. There are times when we overreact to the situations that confront us. Later, we feel remorse and wonder, why the heck did I do that? Judith Siegel says, it's not us, it's our brains. We get flooded with feelings that are too intense to handle, and our reason goes right out the window. But Siegel holds out hope that we can tame the emotional beast. We can train ourselves to stop overreacting, respond more thoughtfully, and end up solving problems instead of making them worse. Judith Siegel teaches social work at NYU. She's an expert on intimacy and family relationships. One focus of her work is prevention against the high divorce rate of parents with young children. She wrote What Children Learn from Their Parents' Marriage, published in 2000 by HarperCollins. And her new book is Stop Overreacting, out from New Harbinger Press. I visited Siegel in her office at NYU's Silver School of Social Work to talk with her about the book. Judith Siegel, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Stop Overreacting, when I saw the title, I said, I've got to read that book. Tell us, first of all, why did you decide to do this book?
You know, Francesca, I have been in the field, both as a therapist working with couples and families and individuals, for 35 years. So over that span, I have encountered a lot of theories. I've contributed to some, but they come from models. They're hypothetical. We have clinical experiences that can confirm it or not. And in the last decade, for the first time, we've got neuroimaging studies that actually show what goes on inside the brain. And it's a very exciting, almost revolutionary experience. And I was so excited to come across these studies and the theories on emotional regulation. It's affected how I work with people, and I thought that people ought to have a chance to learn about it for themselves.
How common a problem do you think this is?
I think we all overreact. If you take a look at the studies, we're all hardwired to have a response, which is both in our bodies and in our mind. It's just a question of how sturdy a person is, which means how likely are they to overreact instead of reacting thoughtfully. And then what is the nature of the trigger? So not all intense reactions are overreactions. The answer is what's going on in the brain right now as you respond to this trigger.
Okay, so you say, for example, that there is a difference between having strong emotions and overreacting. Could you tease that out for us, the difference between the two?
Sure. If you were wired up to a CAT scan or there was another neuroimaging device and an event happened in your life, we would see that the amygdala, which is in the right part of your brain, lights up. Now, if it's an intense reaction, but you're still thoughtful, you're going to also see the parts in the left hemisphere and also the neural network, because suddenly you're going to want to attach meaning, you're going to want to make sense of this, and you're going to want to reach into acquired wisdom. You might want to reflect on the situation and actually confirm to yourself what you're feeling. So all of those different functions, self-awareness, awareness of others, and judgment, mean that while the amygdala may have been the first thing that lit up, now we're going to see, like a beautiful piece of art, like a Christmas tree, all the other parts of your brain becoming involved. Now, your body also is going to respond. It always does when the amygdala gets excited. And so we may find that your heart is pounding or that you've broken out into a sweat. Your thoughts might be racing. But let's contrast that. That was a powerful and intense experience, but all the parts of your brain were connected. In contrast, if you find yourself going right away to a physical response where you become agitated and then you either overreact or underreact, the neural network closes down. And you may not even be aware of that, but you're being flooded with memories from the past. The feelings grow out of proportion because there's an event going on which has brought out, like a Pandora's box, other instances and examples. Your own ability to make judgments or even to be fully aware has been severely compromised, and the neuroimaging would show it because only your amygdala is wired.
Now, you say severely compromised, and you talked about being thoughtful. I know that when I feel like I'm often caught unawares. I feel like when I'm in a situation where I end up overreacting, up until the moment that I actually overreact, I think I've got myself pretty much in control. And then all of a sudden, I lose it. And when I lose it, I'm not being thoughtful. I'm not able to think about what are the associations I'm having. I really don't know how to control it. How do you kind of get ahead of this sudden wave that just sends you over the edge?
You know, Francesca, a lot of people, when they start really thinking about emotional overreactions, sound like you do, believing that it was just like someone flicked a switch. That's how some of my patients describe it. But as they become more attuned to understanding what goes on in their bodies typically when they have an overreaction, they actually become more familiar with a racing heartbeat, or their palms start to sweat, or, you know, so there are a number of symptoms that their body is actually saying, my amygdala is getting pretty worked up right now. My body's starting to go into a state of hyperarousal. What we often do, and this is one error that we could try to concentrate on making, you know, improving, is to use the information from our body to decide that what the most important thing is to get back and get centered. Instead, people become tricked. They find that the problem is the bait, and they jump in and they start thinking about the problem. The more they think about the problem, the more their amygdala gets worked up, and before they know it, it is like someone flicked a switch because they've focused on the problem instead of really thinking about, I think I'm getting too excited. How can I get more centered?
So that even before they, so in a way what you're saying that people should get back to their body, and then that can give them the space to think about the problem again?
That's one of the recommendations I make. I also tell people to think about their overall situation. You know, when you're working with children, you can see that when they're hungry and when they're tired, they're more likely to have a tantrum, and we never really outgrow that. So there are certain times in the day, or there's certain kinds of even, you know, moments of being stressed out. There's so many studies that show that when we're enduring a lot of stress, we're more vulnerable to overreacting. I know for myself, when it approaches 9:30, 10 o'clock in the evening, I'm worn out. I'm really too tired to deal with anything new or challenging. And so learning that these are my vulnerable times, and if a problem emerges, this is a good time for me to say, you know, I'm too tired to deal with this right now. It's going to wait until the morning when I'm fresh, when I can be more centered and thoughtful without having to work so hard at it.
Now, some people explode. Some people shut down. Talk about the difference between these two. Is this a genetic thing? Is this a brain style? Or does this, you know, is this nature or is this nurture?
You know, Francesca, I'm not sure that we really know that answer yet, but we do know that young children can only tolerate feelings for a certain length of time. And when emotions become overwhelming and there's no one there to soothe them, they will shut down. It's as if their body is saying, I can't be here anymore. And so we see that shutdown is the more severe reaction, and that when we have children who've been severely traumatized or have endured considerable stress and loss, we see that they tend to shut down or dissociate or move the whatever the stressor or stimuli is further away from their awareness. Dissociation, for example, is a form of shutting down. Having said that, it's not an abnormal response, and that many people do shut down without having endured that level of stress. So we don't have a perfect answer.
And now, what about the other style, the exploding style?
You know, as someone who works with families, I think that we do inherit likeness to the families we grow up. Is that a genetic response, or is it because we've been conditioned and exposed to them as the models? So I would say that, you know, you should ask yourself what it was like growing up in your own family. But the main issue, I think, is that whether you implode or explode, there's probably a healthier way of dealing with emotions that get you out of control.
We're talking with Judith Siegel. She's a family therapist who's been looking at the research on what happens in the brain when we overreact. Her book is Stop Overreacting: Effective Strategies for Calming Your Emotions. You mentioned the amygdala. That's the part of the brain, the reptilian brain, the emotional brain. What part of the brain can we engage when we're being more thoughtful?
When you've started to move from the right brain, which is the storehouse of these strong emotions, into the various functions of the left brain, you're going to see immediate results. So something as simple as naming your feeling and measuring the feeling asks you to use the left parts of the brain that both retrieve names, language, and also the mathematical concepts. So the more different areas of the brain that you engage in the moment, the more activity moves away from the right brain and the amygdala. You can remind yourself of a bigger picture and bringing old memories that you choose, and also asking yourself judgment level questions, that brings yet another level of the brain. So in the book, I try to, you know, provide people with maybe 20 different kinds of strategies that it's hard to say which one is going to work for you. But anything that takes you into the left brain and expands the neural network is a positive thing.
So this brings to mind the old saw that you should count to 10.
Well, counting to 10 would be fine, but while you're counting to 10, don't focus on the problem, because if you're really thinking about the problem and you start deciding that you're really entitled to all of these emotions, what you're doing is you're constantly re-exposing the amygdala to the stressor. So if you're going to count to 10, imagine that you're counting to 10 in a much calmer place where there's space between you and the situation.
Entitled to these emotions?
Well, very often when you get people, in the book I describe something called splitting. And when people are seeing things entirely one way, they often feel entitled to their position. At the moment, they're very certain that the way they're viewing the world is entirely correct, and they're justified in their response. But in retrospect, we often can see things that were just invisible at that moment, and we kind of can judge ourselves harshly or at least have deep regret that we really didn't know. We came to rapid conclusions without checking things out.
Yeah, actually, you call this, you say that we have schemas. Maybe you could tell us, what's a schema and what are some typical schemas that people may have?
Well, a schema is simply your mental roadmap. So it's a way that you've organized information so that you don't always have to invent the wheel. You can walk into a baseball stadium and know that this is a good place to have popcorn and scream and yell, but you would walk into a library and know that the behavior that was appropriate in the baseball stadium doesn't belong here. No one has to tell you. You're drawing on something that you've come to a conclusion based on many years of experience. So psychologists say that's a schema. It's a belief system that you've acquired. What I think is that we file those experiences away. I use the analogy of a file cabinet, so that it's got two drawers. One is where we put all of the all good schema and the positive emotional memories, and the other one is the all bad. And what's interesting to me is that schemas can be interrelated. So if you've suddenly had an experience and your bad drawer opens where all of your memories that are connected to this event are going to help inform you, you're at high risk because there's going to be other experiences which may not be entirely related to this, but because they're connected closely enough to that schema, the whole meaning system and, unfortunately, old emotional pain is going to pop out, kind of like the Pandora's box analogy.
Could you give us an example?
Well, I think the other thing I'd like to say, though, Francesca, is that everybody's schemas are unique. We like to be able to kind of have general ideas about, you know, how the way the world works for you know, many people. And in reality, your schema is an actual experience of something that happened to you. And it's composed of, you know, the real players that were involved in your life and the sensitivities based on your emotional response at the time. So what I invite people to do, and in the book I give exercises at the end of some of these chapters, I think it's worth your while to ask yourself questions that are going to open up a level of awareness about your own unique schemas, because ultimately, we are more able to understand our emotional world and make sense of, you know, early triggers because we've identified the vulnerable schemas in our own personal lives.
And the book is Stop Overreacting, Effective Strategies for Calming Your Emotions. And we're talking now with Judith Siegel. She's Associate Professor of Social Work at New York University School of Social Work. So there was something. Oh yeah. Now, when I came in here, I told you that I was still recovering from something that happened to me yesterday. Or interesting choice of words. I said happened to me. I overreacted, and yet it does feel as if something happened to me. I'm still experiencing the, you know, the aftermath of the emotions, the feeling of, you know, I have to say, shame, wish I hadn't, you know, lost my cool, no matter how great the trigger may have been. Could you talk a little bit about what are both the physical and the emotional effects on people when they do overreact or underreact?
The truth is that when we overreact, we hurt the people around us and we also hurt ourselves. And so your description of being remorseful and ashamed would be very typical. Sometimes without you have the ability to, in the moment, engage in your emotions and to name your feelings. So I can see that your left and right brains are actively connected. As opposed to someone else who just might struggle with yet a whole new set of emotions that are nameless to them. But because they are upset in some way, they may be prompted to do something to more or less undo the harm they've done, often setting up a cycle where some of the things that we do to appease people or to make up for what we've done often even set us further in the cycles of why things went wrong to begin with.
What do you mean by that, for example?
Well, in the book, I give an example of a mother who's under tremendous financial pressure, and yet she's wanted to indulge her daughter in a new dress and really supporting her prom as a reward for all of the compromises and help that her daughter has helped her during the year. When her daughter rather casually tells her how much a dress is that she's wanting to buy, the mother explodes, very angry, furious that her daughter takes for granted that she can have this kind of a money to spend on something frivolous like a prom. But later she feels tremendous regret. Now, things are even worse when we do something that I call disidentify. So if you grew up in a family where there was a lot of intense reactivity and people were screamers and they maybe embarrassed you, you might have decided that you're never going to do that, that when you're an adult, you're never going to talk to someone else that way. We're never able to fully control that. And if that's your family background and your decision to not be like someone in your family, then if you find yourself acting that way, it's much more difficult for you to face yourself because you've failed on too many fronts.
Yeah. Now, Judith Siegel, in your book, Stop Overreacting, you mentioned some common triggers. I mean, as you said before, everyone's schemas are individual, but there are some common triggers, and as I read them, they were very familiar to me. Envy, rejection, criticism, and control. And I wonder if we could spend a little bit of time on each one of them, because I found this one of the more fascinating parts of your book, just to really see, oh, that's right, that's how these feelings cause these kinds of trigger, these kinds of overreactions. So envy, what happens with that? What is the whole kind of situation around envy that just sets us off so much?
The thing that I find most interesting about envy is that very few people admit to it. It's a very common trigger. It's universal. In fact, if you look at different societies, you'll see that envy and the response to envy has been very fundamental throughout the world and probably throughout time. Yet most people, when they're asked if they're feeling envious, would say, oh, no, that's not something that I experience. Envy is a two-person's scenario. In other words, someone gets something that you feel should have come to you, or that you deserved, or that you feel was perhaps unfair, and that you're flooded with a sense of helplessness and resentment, and often some ill will towards the person who got what it is that you think you deserved. And these feelings combine in a very powerful way.
Now, what are some ways that we can tolerate envy? Because you talk about tolerating these, learning to tolerate the feelings that come up with these kinds of triggers.
Often, it's taking a look at the assumptions and beliefs you have about the situation. If you find that you're splitting, that means that you feel perhaps that you'll never get what you're entitled to, or you see it as being an all bad situation that will never change.
I next asked Judith Siegel about rejection. At the time of our interview, the case of Phoebe Prince in South Hadley, Massachusetts, was much in the news. Prince was a student in the local high school and had been mocked on the internet by fellow students. She took her own life. I asked Judith Siegel how we can deal with rejection and what might she tell young people about how to deal with it.
Well, rejection is a very painful feeling. In fact, the part of the brain that picks up rejection is the same part of the brain that picks up physical pain. So very often when you say that rejection hurts, it actually does hurt. You can feel it in your gut like someone punched you. The reason that rejection is so powerful is partly because of social acceptance. We're hardwired to survive as a species, and that means that we need to be in relationships. We need to have a group experience in order to survive. So rejection is involved in a sense of personal safety. It's also the basis of self-esteem. And when children are in middle school, and this is, I think, when bullying is at its worst, there's a way of trying to establish pecking order and your value. And so being accepted by a group of people that you admire and want to be a part of is very critical to your own identity. This is unfortunately when children are at their most vicious and most likely to bully or reject someone and taunt them as they come to terms with their own very difficult experience of knowing who they are and where they stand in the eyes of others.
And again, so what would you counsel somebody in terms of being able to tolerate? What are some of the, I mean, of course, everyone has to come up in a way with their own script, but in your book, Judith Siegel, Stop Overreacting, I found that you gave some, what felt to me really good sound guidance and some things that people can tell themselves as they learn to get a handle on their feelings and stop overreacting.
Since we're talking about middle school children, though, I think what I'd like people to understand is the importance of parenting, or even to, if you're a school counselor, people who have access to children when they're experiencing rejection can play a very vital role. The worst thing that we can do is to make a child feel alone or unimportant. And the best thing that we can do is help them connect their neural networks in a sense of a secure relationship. So giving a child who's been offended or hurt, even if we feel that they're overreacting and that the slight or the problem that they have, their grievance is insignificant compared to our day and our problems, what we really ought to do is understand that at the moment the child is overreacting and coming with, you know, this heart-wrenching pain, that what we can do is help them talk and feel understood and then learn how to appraise the situation, describe their feelings, and look at how they can solve the problem from a different perspective. And if you're an adult and you have the privilege of helping a young child sort through these intense, painful reactions, you've just done an amazing miracle that's going to help that young person today and for years to come.
You are a family therapist as well, as having studied and written about these kinds of issues that affect individuals outside the family context as well as within. It seems to me things are a lot more complicated within the family dynamic because, you know, I've noticed sometimes it seems that one person may try to not overreact, be more thoughtful, and yet another person is somehow invested in keeping the temperature high, let's say, of the interreaction between them. So what are some ways that you might suggest where people can work together, or one person in a family can help to shift the dynamic even when the other person keeps on trying to drag it back to a level of overreacting?
The interesting thing is that feelings are contagious. Emotions are contagious. So if your partner or someone in your family has an excited, overreactive amygdala, that it's very easy for yours to get excited as well. And so that's the first piece of advice, which is to understand that that's the worst thing that can happen. If you're dealing with fire and then you respond with more fire, that just creates an explosion. Instead, you want to remain calm yourself. And, you know, what your partner is trying to do is be heard. And that's what I find, that people, when they feel like they have no control over a situation and they're not being heard, they're not getting the reaction that they want, and so they become very excited. Your ability to say to them, I know you're frustrated, in other words, to acknowledge their tension, but to tell them that it's hard for you to kind of stay with the conversation so you can solve it when it's at this emotional pitch. What's interesting to me is that many people, when they're overreacting, have lost all self-awareness. Of course, that's a left brain function. And you can ask them, how angry are you? And you could be with someone who's completely melted down, red in the face, screaming at the top of their lungs. And if you say, you look like you might be angry, they may not have any awareness of that at the moment. So if you understand that your partner is out of control, the best thing you can do is help them calm down. I don't know that they're necessarily invested in keeping the temperature hot. I think they're just frustrated that there's no power, there's no control, and that they're not being heard.
So maybe it's not so much they're invested in keeping the temperature hot, it's that they can't get off that level of heat. Now, I have noticed, however, if you say to somebody, calm down, it usually has the opposite reaction.
If calm down means shut up, then of course it does. If calm down is said in a loving and connected way, I want to be with you, I'm concerned that you're this upset, but right now the way we're approaching it isn't going to work for me. How can we either, you know, let's just have a cup of tea or figure out if there's something we can do for 10 minutes and give ourselves both a chance to cool down. Too many people have the belief, and probably out of experience, that if the subject gets dropped, it never gets raised again. And so they're invested in staying with something because it's so vital to them. It feels so important to them at the moment. If your pattern is that you can assure your partner or family member that you are going to stick with this story, but you need a little bit of time so that both of you can cool down, that's not the same thing as being told or inferred that you're irrelevant and that I'm not going to give you the time you need to solve this.
Or I'm superior to you because I'm calm and you're not.
That would be another way to get somebody very upset. That would fire their amygdala for sure.
So just in the last few weeks, as we're doing this interview right now, and we're talking here at the end of July, we've heard a lot about Mel Gibson in the news, someone who is pretty famous right now for overreacting. What do you do with people who are being abusive? In other words, I guess I'm asking, what is the line between abuse and this kind of more understanding way of understanding that somebody just really needs to be heard? Do you understand the question here?
Well, I do, because domestic violence is one of the areas of my research. And so, you know, trying to help people understand what goes on in their brains and bodies when they're emotionally out of control doesn't excuse it. It never excuses violence. And that even if the partner tries to be calm, they're not to be blamed for having excited the abusive partner, nor is it their job to figure out how to fix it. At that moment, every individual has to take full responsibility. But what I try to do in the book is describe different scenarios and also personality styles where splitting and entitlement are more common. And I'm not going to diagnose Mel Gibson, but I do think that there are many people who are narcissistically grandiose, and that puts them at high risk because they need to have higher levels of control, and they experience things as criticism, and they tend to have more intense reactions. Of course, the answer is still that it's ultimately their responsibility to understand and to change themselves.
And the book is Stop Overreacting: Effective Strategies for Calming Your Emotions. We've, in many ways, just skimmed the surface of this book. It's fascinating. It's got exercises that you can do, questions that you can answer that can help you figure out what are your own triggers and how to deal with them. I want to thank you so much, Judith Siegel, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Francesca.
Judith Siegel teaches social work at NYU. You can find tips from her on identifying how you overreact and what to do about it by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, biofeedback pioneer Les Femi talks about his method for helping us focus and calm our stress. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first half of our show today, we explored how we overreact in stressful situations. One way we can keep from doing that is by paying attention to our own thoughts, feelings, and sensations, like being aware when we start to get triggered so we can take a step back and cool down in time. Les Femi has been studying attention for more than 40 years. He says you can practice simple techniques to improve your focus and calm your stress, and they don't have to take a lot of time. Even just a few mindful minutes of practice every day, says Femi, can bring huge benefits. He calls this system open focus, and he explains it all in his book and CD set, The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body. In this encore interview from 2008, I spoke with Femi about it. You were one of the pioneers in the field of biofeedback. What got you interested in brain waves and biofeedback?
Well, I had this idea that we should be able to change the way we pay attention and change the way we behave and link those two to brainwave activity. Here I am 40 years later, still quite interested in this, and I have been using what we call open focus training, paying attention in different ways. We usually pay attention in a narrow focus, objective way. And that leads to a lot of stress. In fact, it's called emergency mode attention. It leads to a lot of stress and the accumulation of stress. And if you learn to pay attention in other ways, then one is allowed to release stress and let stress dissipate, dissolve. So you could be in a stressful environment, and if you were stuck in narrow objective attention, stress would accumulate.
Well, let's go right to the meat of it then. You've already entered into it. Your book is The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body. You talk about four different kinds of attention. Tell us what they are.
Sure. The first one, the one that we're mostly engaged in, is what we might call paying attention, where we narrow our focus of attention and look at a rather limited part of the environment. We don't attend to anything outside this rather narrow column of attention. And so we call that narrow attention. And it usually is associated with another kind of attention we call objective attention, where we're separate from what we're looking at and we're making an object of it. And, for example, you may be separate from what I'm saying and listening and objectifying and trying to understand would be, you know, part of the process of accepting.
So a less emotional stance.
It's less emotional, yes. It's objective. It's the kind of attention that scientists love, you know, objective attention. They want to very carefully and precisely objectify phenomena.
But don't they say that people remember better when they have an emotional connection? For example, well, in either for ill, like in trauma, or for good, like in love?
Yeah, well, it could work that way. It could work oppositely, too. You want to block it, and you can't remember it. So even very good things might be blocked, not necessarily intentionally, but, for example, if you're in narrow focus and you're attending to, say, something you're reading, everything else is blocked. So we have this mechanism for blocking experience right there, ready for us, all well learned, taught to us by our teachers and our friends and our parents and just about everyone. Everybody wants us to pay attention to them.
Well, you know, this is actually a problem I struggle with a lot. I'm one of those people who has ADD, and, you know, it's called attention deficit, but it's really, to me, I think of it as dysregulation, because just what you say, I can be reading a book and somebody can come right up to me and call my name, and it's only like about the fourth or fifth time they say my name that it penetrates. So what, talk about this open, now I guess you've talked about two different kinds of narrow attention. What are the other kinds of attention that one can use?
There are two others that I deal with. I'm sure there are others, but these are the major forms of attention as I understand what we're doing here. And the third one would be a kind of opening of attention, like right now while you're listening to me, you might include being aware of many objects in the periphery of your attention, maybe other senses, not only vision, and you may become aware of seeing space and hearing silence while you're listening to what I'm saying. So the third kind is a kind of opening of attention, a diffusing, so that you become wider in attentional scope. The fourth kind has to do with what might be looked at as the opposite of objective attention, and that is immersed attention. One is so immersed, and I think you were alluding to this before, you're so immersed you don't hear anything. In fact, you can disappear as a person to your own awareness. And this isn't uncommon. We do this every day. We disappear and reappear. For example, if you're into sports at all, you may have noticed that some days when you're out there doing apparently very well, you're disappearing a lot of the time. If you talk to people in the realm of sports, the best of them can come off a court and say, how did I do? And not be that aware. Musicians say this all the time. Performing artists, they become the experience.
Now, I want to go back to the open focus, because even just as you were saying to me, you know, as you're listening to me, you know, you might turn your attention to what you see in your peripheral vision, etc. I found myself relaxing immediately.
Very good. That's generally what happens. And some people are not aware that they relax because they're not tuned into that aspect of their physiology. But that's exactly what happens. So imagine that if you were paying attention in two of these ways. One is a narrow focus, which you're directing various places, like, say, visually looking at the screen or looking at your body or whatever. And around that, there's a much bigger, more diffused awareness. So while you're centered in a narrow focus way on something, you can also see the space all around you, feel it, hear the silence, and experience space in your other senses as well.
But might that not diffuse our attention? Can we still pick up what we need to?
Actually, it doesn't. It allows us to function in a more focused way more, because it doesn't accumulate effort and tension and stress. Unfortunately, narrow objective attention, when overdone, which is my thesis that we all overdo it, as we overdo it, we accumulate stress and tension and come down with all the symptoms that modern-day man suffers.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking to Les Femi about how to focus so as to deal more gracefully with all the aspects of our lives. His book is The Open Focus Brain. Well, talk a little bit more about this connection between stress and the narrow focus.
Narrow objective attention is like the attention paid by the lion on a hunt, and stalking his victim and following every motion. And you might notice that the lion is tensed up somewhat and very focused and holding that until his own physiology reaches a point where he leaps into the chase. And this is all brought about and orchestrated by the way he's paying attention. Attention is the organizing function of our activity. So without, you know, the ability to change the way we pay attention, we can't say we wanted to and couldn't get into narrow objective attention. Well, then we would lose out on our ability to be in emergency mode and catch the prey if we were a lion. So this is a valuable thing, to be able to jump into narrow focus objective attention, which is what I call emergency mode. And then after the chase, after the hunt, successful or not, to open the focus again and merge with experience and rest, recuperate, let stress diffuse, so that one is optimally ready for the next occasion to apply narrow objective attention.
You make a link with anxiety, you've just said here. Actually, you have a pretty interesting theory about ADD that I haven't heard before. You say that it's connected to anxiety. In other words, it has a more psychological than a brain-based cause. Am I reading you right? And by the way, for our listeners, we are talking with Les Femi. He's the author of The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body, and he's a pioneer in biofeedback and neurofeedback.
So the question is, how do I tie in anxiety? Well, if you were in a clinical setting, as I have been for 40 years, if you had an opportunity during the first session to interview people closely as to, you know, how their life progresses and what they feel and what the problems are, you might, like I do, connect anxiety with many, many dysfunctional behaviors and feelings. This is the simple story, and that is that the more we pay attention in narrow focus, the more anxious and stressed we become. And what we want to do is dissolve the stress. By the way, I'm ADHD also, and that's why attention has always been an important thing in my research career and my interests. So if we reduce anxiety, then lots of abilities return to us. It's easier to open our focus. It's easier to merge with our experience. It's easier to pay attention in a narrow, objective way also, just by reducing anxiety. So the main goal for initial training is to reduce anxiety, to help a person learn to produce the brainwave activity associated with reduced anxiety.
We're based here at a university campus. Talk about attention and learning. I think this kind of follows on what you just said, but I wonder if you have an explanation for a phenomenon that I observed when I was in college. I love to read. That's why I do this show, and I have no problem staying awake while I'm reading now. But when I was in school, no matter how interested I was, I always fell asleep over my assigned reading. Is there some kind of an attentional issue going on here?
Well, certainly it is. I mean, what kind of attention did you bring to this assigned reading, and how was it different from the kind of attention you brought to desired reading?
You know, even if I wanted to read it, I think there was that kind of issue. There was a certain anxiety, and there was that sense that I have to do this.
And I have to do it well. And then the feeling that you have to tighten up and become tense and try hard. And that's very tiring. And it's a mechanism itself. Dropping out is a mechanism of managing your awareness.
Wow. Well, that's very useful kind of insight on that. With your book, The Open Focused Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body, you have a CD that has exercises on it, and you also have the same exercises in the book. Could you give us an example, just a brief example, of how somebody could use this method? Give us an example of an exercise, maybe a simple, brief
right.
one.
Right. One of my cautions to my clients is that they not operate a vehicle while listening to the tapes. And the reason is that attention can change quite rapidly and dramatically. And we don't want them behind the wheel struggling, you know, trying to pay attention to driving and then have some release phenomenon of significant degree that it would make that difficult. Make driving difficult. So I hesitate to actually give you an example over the air because some of your listeners obviously will be driving. But I can tell you about the exercise and the idea behind the exercise. In general, the idea behind the exercise is to create a larger sphere of awareness than we usually do. And when you develop a larger awareness, a larger scope of awareness, you widen out visual perception, for example, so that you could see peripherally quite a bit, and you attend to space as well, so you see space and see objects peripherally and centrally. When you do that, anything that happens, say something in your narrow focus, it becomes small stuff. It's a small percentage of the total of your experience. And that's its value. As you open your focus, you go through life and things don't overwhelm you. They don't produce anxiety as often or as much. And the idea is to gradually merge with a more dispassionate kind of awareness, which is possible simply by broadening your attention to include as many senses as are available to you.
How is this different from meditation?
Well, meditation has so many meanings and involves so many different practices that I avoid it. It's just too hard to bring meditation in without knowing the kind and type of meditation that we're talking about. So this has similar effects. I think it's faster. That is, open focus training is faster. And one realizes more directly some of the benefits of practice. And I believe that many forms of meditation are also attention training, but they're different than what we do. We emphasize the experience of space, and I'm not personally aware in detail of others who do that, like yogis and such, but recently someone told me that he was in India, and there was a yogi who was using space, and it makes sense to me. I mean, being aware of space is releasing, is letting go. Space goes everywhere, through everything, and extends limitlessly in every direction. So that kind of opening is a very effective release.
And when you say space, you're not just talking about, say, the space beyond us, but also at a real micro level too. Kind of the space inside your nose, between your eyes.
Yes, the feeling of space, as well as seeing it and hearing it, hearing silence and experiencing the internal dialogue in your mind and the space in which it occurs, and mind space, visual space. The images that occur in your mind occur in a kind of visual space also. So we're talking about feeling, hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, thinking, and a sense of time or timelessness.
We're talking about attention and how to harness it in order to heal mind and body. Our guest is Les Femi. He's a pioneer in the field of biofeedback and the author of The Open Focus Brain. Now, you mentioned, here's another phrase you mentioned, that is phase synchronous alpha. I mean, we know there are different brain waves. There's beta, alpha, theta, and delta. Without going into each one of them, talk a little bit about this phase synchronous alpha. It's a little bit different, and that's kind of that's the goal here in your method.
Yes, that's one of the goals, and a very, very important one in this method. Phase synchrony means a kind of harmony is occurring with the waves measured at different points on the scalp and in the brain. So phase synchrony means when all the waves at all the locations being monitored are in phase with each other, are going up at the same time and then going down at the same time. They're in harmony with each other, in synchrony. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it almost reminds me of kind of parallel processing in a computer. You know, the more, and I don't even know how that works, but I guess the more electrons that can be harnessed at any one time, the more computing can be done.
There may be some similarities.
Now, something else that you write in your book that I found quite interesting is that you work with people with autism. And now we know that autism is, unfortunately, you know, the number of people who with autism seems to be rising quite a bit. People talk about an autism epidemic. Tell us about the work that you've done using the open focus method.
There's an element of autism that suggests that the person is not immersing themselves in the situation. They don't even immerse themselves in the feeling of presence of their own body. And one of the things we do is we monitor preferentially the brain waves in the parietal lobe, which are associated with feeling body, feeling particularly. And in doing that, we increase the contact that people showing symptoms of autism have. So that's one of the things, that is, we emphasize this parietal lobe activity. But in addition, we emphasize synchrony of the parietal lobes. And in that, apparently, is what happens to these people. When we give them feedback as to when they're in phase with each other, they learn a kind of intimacy, a kind of union with their body and with others around them. One mother said that her son, who was autistic, demonstrated an unusual ability to feel and to experience intimately. His brother and a sister, he actually played with them for the first time. He kissed his sister on the cheek. And it was just a remarkable demonstration of how powerful it can be for some people. I wouldn't suggest to anyone that it works extremely well for every autistic patient.
And you've also, have you or others have worked with Down syndrome folks with this. Now, that I found quite phenomenal. You said you've been able to raise IQ by, you know, quite measurably.
Yes, that's the work of Jerry Fee. She was able to increase IQs rather dramatically.
How could that work? Down syndrome, it's a congenital disorder. It has to do with, you know, different configuration of the genes. Why do you imagine that this kind of therapy can actually work, can actually change IQ?
I could speculate that the way you pay attention has a dramatic impact on your IQ. So if you're stuck in one form of attention, let's say stuck in narrow objective attention, you don't have an intimacy with yourself, with material you could learn. So I'm suggesting that attentional flexibility is the general solution to a lot of problems, a whole lot of problems.
And I have to say, I've been using some of these techniques, and I also noticed a difference. We've been talking with Les Femi. He is the author of The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body. And I want to thank you, Les Femi, for coming on to Writer's Voice. I think this is a wonderful tool for everybody, but also for students here on the campus of University of Massachusetts.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share my work with you.
And that was Les Femi. You can go to writersvoice.net for links to Femi's website, where you can find out more about his open focus techniques. That was Les Femi. We talked with him in 2008 about his book, Open Focus Brain. You can find links to more information about his open focus method at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.